Welcome to another episode of All Movie Talk. If you can figure out the question, well, I got the answer. It's episode 42. And we're going to kick things off with another famous frame. Steven, I'm really sick of doing these. We should change it up a little. Maybe do Film Buffs dictionaries once in a while instead. But anyway, famous frame. We're going to do E.T., a particular frame from that movie. Also, of course, we'll have our trivia question and a second take. Remember us talking about Pixar? Well, we've seen another Pixar movie and we want to talk to you about it. Our top six list this week is movies you would like to see remade. And wrapping things up, the conclusion to our director's spotlight of the Coen brothers, I'm Sam Stoddard.
I'm Stephen Keller. And you know, actually, Sam, I think we need to revise that little listing you just gave because, you know, I just feel like that industry trend on the blacklist could have been better. So I'm going to say we're going to remake it, actually, this time. So maybe we'll push Coen's to next time. And we're going to do industry trend, the blacklist, all over again. How's that sound?
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Well, I hope it's a faithful remake. I really want to make sure that we don't disappoint the fans of that segment by changing it around.
Honestly, I felt the original one, the ending was good, but not enough action. So in this version, I'm thinking maybe Dalton Trumbo is going to like assault the floors of Congress with an assault rifle and a hot chick sidekick.
That sounds like it could work. Well, let's see.
Sam, remember back in episode 13 where we did that recurring segment called Famous Frame? We talked about the image.
Did we do something like that?
Yeah, we talked about the image of Gene Kelly.
Oh, yeah, that recurring segment.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'd gotten up to, I think we've got up to one of those at that time.
Well, this is part two. That was part one.
Oh.
So this is part two.
Excellent.
A little bit of a delay.
I'm excited.
Anyway, so the idea behind this segment, if you've forgotten, and I can't blame you if you did, because it's been literally months since we did it, there's all these really famous single images from movies out there, and it's worth taking a look at them and talking about them and exploring about what it is that makes them work. Because, you know, we often talk about movies within context of scenes or sequences, but here's interesting because what about movies that have just really interesting still images? And so today we're going to talk about one of the classic images from the 1980s, something I remember very vividly from my childhood, and it's a shot from E.T., and if I mention the film E.T. by Steven Spielberg, I'm going to guarantee that the shot that springs to mind is almost certainly the one we're talking about, and that's the image of the main character Elliot and the little alien E.T. on the bicycle, silhouetted against a giant full moon as the bicycle flies up in front of it. Now, just in and of itself, that's a wonderfully cool idea for an image. If it were just a still photograph and there were no movie associated with it, that would still be a neat image because it's just, first of all, I'm just a sucker for anything that shows a gigantic seeming moon. You know, when you see like the moon right on the horizon, it seems huge. That's always cool. I just always like that. It's a very striking image. But then you get this totally surreal element of, you know, clearly someone on a bicycle pedaling in front of it, flying in the air. That's just neat. What do you think just about the image itself, Sam? What is it about that makes it interesting?
Oh, it's a great image. Actually, Spielberg seems to be in love with this idea anyway. You think of you know, some of his other movies, Empire of the Sun. He's used this image a lot. And you know, you can get to recognizing Spielberg's work by the lighting, in fact. You know, it's not just the giant orb in the sky. It's the effect that giant lights have. You know, Close Encounters, a lot of great lighting at the end of that. I think if we distill Spielberg's obsession with this image and we get the most, you know, perfect expression of that, it would be in E.T. in that scene you're talking about, where he managed to capture what was exciting to him personally about this kind of visual idea and convey that in a movie in just an absolutely pure form. And it's certainly, I mean, obviously it's a memorable form because, I mean, it was adopted as the Amblin Entertainment logo. So, you know, I mean, how much more compelling does it have to be as an image?
Right, and of course it's the image that gets used on the posters and all the advertising. And I mean, just even if you don't know anything else about the movie, just seeing that, okay, there's at one point in time a scene where for some reason a bicycle is going to be flying in front of this gigantic illuminated full moon and be completely silhouetted. I mean, it just conjures up all these images of freedom and wonder and childhood. And I mean, that encapsulates what E.T. is all about, really and truly. I mean, just I think actually, just as a digression, E.T. is a little underrated, maybe as a great Spielberg movie. I mean, certainly it's a pop icon from the 1980s, but you know, in light of Spielberg's other great, more dramatic or more adult oriented kind of movies, it gets lost a little bit. But you know, this sequence just in and of itself is so amazing, and it, you know, if you consider how well it works in the context of the film and how all the great memories it conjures of the movie. Once you've seen the movie, you know, you can definitely sort of understand why it became such an iconic image.
Absolutely. Because, it was not just a great image by itself, but in context, it comes at a moment in the movie that's a real dramatic, kind of exciting key point.
Right.
And I also think that, obviously humanity, since the dawn of time, has been fascinated with the lights in the heavens and come up with explanations for what they are, and different, you know, some are more scientific, some are more romantic, and it's just, obviously we just love looking up, because when you look up at everything out there, it just kind of puts things in perspective a little bit. You know, you can think about where you are in the universe, and just, you know, where else can you look just to a physical thing and get that same sense of awe. You can climb a mountain and look over the world, that's one way to do it, but you know, the sky is always above us no matter where we are, and so you know, to capture that, if you think about that sense of wonder and then have an image of this kid on a bicycle that is actually able to kind of connect with the heavens a little bit better than we normally can. I mean, he's on a flying bicycle. Great, he's up there with the giant moon. I mean, it's sort of a wish fulfillment in a way. As we get this this sense of wonder, and now, hey, here's a kid who can go there a little bit and get a little bit closer to something that is interesting to us.
Yeah, so I think it really does work as an image, and of course it works in the context of the movie so beautifully. Certainly the most memorable moment from a movie, with a lot of cool moments. Always something neat about that shot. I've always been a fan of it, and I think, you know, go take a look at it. If you haven't seen it in a while, I'm sure everyone can picture it in their head, but go take a look at it. Maybe watch E.T. again when that moment comes up. Freeze frame it on the DVD and just check it out and think for a moment about how awesome and wonderful it feels.
We'll be talking about remakes a little later on in the show, or at least remakes that we would like to see, and so this week's trivia question will be somewhat related, and it's a remake that actually happened, and it's what Michael Bay summer action movie is actually a remake of a movie that was previously featured on Mystery Science Theater 3000. Sounds crazy, but there is such a title, and we'll tell you what it is at the end of the show. If you remember back in episode 37, we talked about the Pixar animated features, and there were 7 features out at that time, and since then, Ratatouille has been released to theaters, and both Steven and I have seen it, and I think we got 8 in a row now, 8 great movies in a row. What do you think?
I don't know that I consider, say, Cars to be a great movie, but certainly 8 good movies in a row, and here's a great one.
Yeah, I mean, strange to be saying this, I think Ratatouille is my favorite Pixar movie. I mean, it's just relentlessly creative. Here's one of the things I liked about it, just talk about the story a little bit. It makes the most it possibly can out of its premise. I mean, the idea is that you have a rat that can cook. And there's a couple of different ways to play a story like that. It's right away you're dealing with an obstacle. I mean, rats around food, kind of a off-putting kind of idea. So, one, you could try to make the rats nice and cute and sidestep that whole matter, or you can confront it and actually use that and make that part of the story and part of the obstacle that the characters have to overcome. So it's not problem with your movie. So that's one thing I thought it did very well. It kind of used that creepiness about rats touching our food, and yet in contrast came up with this rat character who wants to be different, doesn't want to be rat-like. And I thought that was a very clever way to approach that material.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very, you know, obviously part of what they do is that they humanize him and set him aside for the other rats. Well, you know, just going back to what you said, I don't know that I'm willing to call this my favorite Pixar movie yet. I think I need, like, you know, 5 years for it to really settle in and compete with Toy Story in my head. But, yeah, certainly right up there. And getting back to making the most of the story, I was amazed at how they were able to visualize certain things, like the idea of taste.
Oh yeah,
there's a couple scenes where he's tasting food and describing
that
them.
That was really cool,
and that's visually stunning what they end up doing. A cool way to kind of illustrate it. It's hard to explain unless you've seen it, but you know that's something that you shouldn't be able to show visually how food tastes and how that taste excites you and what starts happening in your head. And a couple different ways they manage to do it. I'm especially thinking of. One of the most surprising bits is sort of toward the end when one of the critics tastes the food. And
oh, yeah.
That was a brilliant little bit of business. Just
spectacular.
Gosh,
yeah.
You don't need to do that either. That was something that you did not absolutely need. That you could have conveyed that just through dialogue. But
well, I don't know, actually. This was one of the points I was going to bring up. I saw this when the food critic was introduced. I saw that this... It's not that I didn't trust that the movie would do it right, but I saw this as a real pitfall because... There's this critic who's kind of down and stuffy and has a personal problem with this one restaurant, and it just seemed like it was too personal because let's face it, critics are not really accountable to anybody but themselves. And you and I mean, we can like a movie and then tell everybody on this show that we don't like it. I mean, we don't do that, but you know, as you the listener, do you really know that? You just have to trust us, and so part of the the whole thing about being a critic is building that trust. But they set this guy up to have this personal issue, and I couldn't imagine a way that it was going to be convincing because there's going to be a showdown. But I just couldn't think of a way that could happen, and yet the animation, the particular way they illustrate that sense of taste, is exactly what sells it.
Yeah, absolutely. But I again, you know, if they hadn't done it as well, it would still have been a good movie.
Yeah,
but
true.
The fact that they go that extra mile every time they don't need to, and that's what really sets it apart from just being a good movie. It makes it great. I mean, that's one of the last 10 minutes or so, so wonderful.
Yeah.
Just so strong and compelling.
Well, here's another thing that you mentioned, the ways that this movie visualizes things in a different sort of way. I really loved a bit toward the beginning when this rat character is just first starting to explore his new environment. He kind of gets lost from his family and finds himself in a new place. And so you see this very fast-moving, action-y scene, but it's just a scene of him running around this house. And it made me realize just how differently you think of a house being laid out if you were that small. When we think of the layout of a house, we might say, okay, there are two floors, and these rooms are connected by these doorways and these hallways, and, you know, somebody asks where the bathroom is. Well, it's down the hall, first door on the left. You don't say, well, you can go on top of the kitchen cupboards and through that hole behind the water pipe, you know? But the way the rat moves around the house is not what we think of as the layout, the geography of a house. You know, he goes up in the walls and along the pipes and around these corners and through holes in this and that place, and it's such a wonderful, amazing perspective, because here and there we get a glimpse of a room or something that we recognize. We say, oh, we're in this room now, okay. And then he's off somewhere else again. It's a neat sensation.
Yeah, boy. And all those sequences, really, where the rat Remy is running through places are just stunning visually. Oh, my gosh. Just constantly assaulting you with these amazing sights. It took me a little while to really start getting into the story of the movie, because I spent the first half an hour or so just blown away by the visuals, just checking out every little detail I possibly could.
Yeah, and it's going to take a few viewings to pick them all up, too, because it's so quick.
Yeah.
I love the water stuff in the sewers, too. Very beautifully animated.
This is far and away the most stunning visually Pixar film, I think, surpassing Finding Nemo.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty clear thing. You don't need 5 years to digest. I mean, we know that already. I mean, and to be fair, in 5 years, I may, well, even in 6 months, I might change my opinion. But as for the moment, I laughed throughout it. There's these other great sort of emotional charges in it. And the short at the beginning is hilarious, too.
Yeah. I will say, in my review that I wrote right after I watched the movie on the website, I said, you know, this kind of got to me emotionally the same way the two Toy Story films did. And that's something that the other Pixar films haven't really done. I've liked them. I felt connected to the characters. But this one really got to me in exactly that same way.
Yeah.
And that, I think, I walked out of the theater. I had been laughing. I was amazed by the visuals. And I also, though, felt really moved and inspired to think about things. And, you know, you come out of a talking rat movie thinking about, like, the nature of art and criticism. It's that's not what you expect. That's amazing.
There's some great lines in it, too, especially I love there's a kind of a monologue toward the end, without saying too much about what happens, but very well written, and yeah, it does express a point of view and a certain perspective that you maybe haven't thought of before.
The other thing I love about the script is the way there are villains, but there also aren't villains. I feel like maybe only one character, could you say, is a real true villain, kind of, but he's not really even that evil, honestly. He's just kind of greedy and selfish. It's not like some other cartoon movies where there's these one-dimensional, pure evil villains. Everyone gets more or less a fair kind of arc. I thought that was cool.
Yeah. This movie does it all throughout. I mean, it sets itself up for one plot point after another that either can't work or just feels predictable or feels like it's gonna be not so interesting, and then the next moment, it steps up, and it's more than you expect. So, whether it's the greatest Pixar movie or not, I think Stephen and I are both pretty clearly saying you should go see this movie and see it in the theater, because it is visually stunning, and you're not going to quite get that on the small screen. The music, too, is great. I love the music in it. And as for a food movie, it made me hungry.
Yeah, me too, the whole time.
I want to eat all that stuff. You know, it tells you how great the animation was. I mean, the animated food looked delicious. So if that isn't a recommendation, I don't know what is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say, again, I've been watching the big summer blockbusters, the big action CGI movies. This is more visually interesting, more compelling on the big screen than Die Hard or Transformers or Pirates 3, in my opinion. I haven't seen Harry Potter yet while we're recording this. It's before Harry Potter's come out, so maybe that'll top it, but I doubt it. I think this is the most, you know, big screen spectacle movie of the year, probably. As movie fans, I think we're pretty apt to complain when Hollywood remakes a movie. We never want to see a remake of a film that we liked. But what about the other way? You know, why is it that only good movies ever seem to get remade, when really, if you're going to remake something, you should remake something that didn't quite work? So our top six list today is going to be all about the top six movies we would like to see remade. Now, I'm going to just say straight up that my list here probably says a lot more about the movies that I want to like than it does anything else. But I'm just going to go and warn everyone that my list has got a disproportionate number of crappy, high-concept action flicks in it. So you can take that for what you will. But my number six is going to be the film Men in Black Part 2. Perhaps a weird choice to remake. I mean, you know, remake a sequel, but... And I know Sam feels the same way I do, at least about Men in Black Part 1. It was a really, really great, you know, I'll go and say it was in its own way a great film, really fun and clever, and just when sort of computer generated images were becoming new in the movies, becoming a new standard, it was a really neat use of that, and just great pairing of Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones, and so packed full of great moments. And I was so excited for the sequel to come out, and then it was just not good. It was like it came out too long after the first one or something, and everyone's just trying to cash in, make a quick buck. I was so disappointed, and I've always thought that, man, there's so much potential with that universe and those characters. I would love to see somebody go back and revisit it. I know maybe I'm just hoping for a good Men in Black 3, but I mean, that's pretty much impossible. So I just think it's a clever idea for a movie and for a kind of a light action series. And I'd like to see that. I'd like to see that revisited at some point in time.
Yeah, I think with that one, the sequel was trying to be a remake of the first one, and so you want a better remake than the remake. I don't know. Yeah, Men in Black 2 was terrible. I think that was the one where I realized Barry Sonnenfeld was not going to get better from his lapse with Wild Wild West.
Right.
But yeah, the first one was quite a lot of fun. All right, my number six is a movie called Multiplicity, and it's a Michael Keaton comedy from the 90s. It's about, it's a comedy about I haven't seen it since then. I don't remember how the clones come about, but he winds up with a few different clones of himself all trying to live his same life. And, of course, there's all kinds of comic hijinks about, well, what if people find out that there's multiples of us, and how do we all share the bathroom at one time? And, of course, that's also a good excuse to do some special effects to get Michael Keaton in many times, and now that's old hat. But at the time, I guess it was a pretty big deal. But the problem is, it's just not a good movie. It's not very funny, it's not very creative. And that's a killer, because it's a creative idea. I would love, maybe I don't even want a comedy, maybe I want a drama, but I would love a movie about, and not four clones or however many ends up with, just two. Just you have a clone, and maybe you like the idea because you can share work, you can share responsibilities, and then as you get into things, well, number one, you start to realize it's not as practical as that. You both have to eat, you both have to have a life somewhere, you both have to exist. Number two, can you really live with yourself? Are you the kind of person that could live with you if you were not you? You know what I'm saying? I think there's all kinds of potential there, and I think this movie did not touch a whit of it. So I'd love to see a serious or a better version of this, comedy or drama, I guess.
Interesting pick. Maybe I should have included Multiplicity on my guilty pleasures list, because I like it. Some funny parts. I mean, I like Pizza Steve. Anyway, but I get what you're saying, and I like to note that the comic strip Calvin and Hobbes did a much better job talking about the too many duplicates issues.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm going to go back to another high concept action flick that didn't work for me from number five, and that was the film Face Off, directed by John Woo, a movie that I really, 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 really wanted to like and was so excited for because, hey, you get John Woo making this great idea for an action flick, and I won't go into why I don't like the flick. A lot of people do seem to like it. I kind of can't stand it. But I think it's a cool idea. I mean, essentially you have this cop takes the face and the body and voice and everything of a criminal so he can go into prison undercover as the criminal. And then at the same time, the criminal happens to wake up from a coma and take the face of the cop. And so they basically switched bodies now. And, you know, now the criminal has to try and the cop's disguised as the criminal. And you can just see how this could be a really interesting flick. And if it had been done a little more intelligently, how much it could say about identity and how people perceive us based on what they see about us. And you could get some interesting action scenes. And, you know, if you get two actors who are well-suited for it, the original had John Travolta and Nicolas Cage, you could still use those two actors and come up with an interesting flick, I think. But, oh man, the original didn't work for me, and it's just such an interesting, intriguing idea. I was always sad that the film kind of went so by-the-numbers action movie by the end of it.
Well, I got to tell you, I loved Face Off, so I'm not quite with you there. But I kind of see what you're saying, though, because this movie made me really think about the premise of it and get through that, and I kind of think that the movie thought with me to a point, and then it just stopped thinking and didn't really carry through. I would love to see a movie that does cut deeper into the psychological stuff in there. That is interesting. My number five is The Lady and the Lake from the late 40s. It has Robert Montgomery in it, and it's an adaptation of a Raymond Chandler story, one of the Philip Marlowe novels. I think Chandler has had a lot of really interesting movies made from his work. Of course, there's The Big Sleep. That's the definitive one with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. But then you also have Murder, My Sweet, which is based on Farewell, My Lovely. You have Farewell, My Lovely, made in the 70s with Robert Mitchum, so two versions of that story that are both strong. And Lady in the Lake is a really good book. This is, I think, the only time it's been treated to film, and it's an interesting movie, too, but it's doesn't quite work. It's a gimmick. The gimmick is that the camera always shows the first-person view of Philip Marlowe, played by Robert Montgomery, that you hear but never see unless he goes to a mirror or something like that. So the camera's always lots of long takes, walking through corridors and looking at things on desks. You see it pan around a lot as Philip Marlowe looks around, but it sounds fun. I guess the advertising blitz was solve a mystery with Robert Montgomery because you know everything he does. You see what he sees so you can help solve the crime. Doesn't really work. It's a strange thing, especially in the beginning, when you should have two shots or a couple of one shots of people talking to each other. You just see a steady shot on whoever Marlowe's talking to, and during the silences, that's kind of awkward, and the acting not always up to snuff. So, not a bad movie. It's an interesting movie, but I'd love to see a real, solid, good, brilliant version of this novel.
Now, would your remake continue the first-person thing?
No, I've okay. Just
want. So really, just want another adaptation of the novel.
Yeah, I want a good one.
Okay, I tried to shy away from adaptations because I'm not sure if you're just asking. That really, I don't know. Does that count? Because how many books could I list that have been butchered that I'd like to see?
Well, apparently you didn't list any.
Well, I do actually have an adaptation, but I try to stay away from them.
Okay.
But, well, my number four is a flick that I think I've probably mentioned here before that I kind of like. It almost made my guilty pleasures list, actually, but it didn't quite get there. And that is the film The Long Kiss Goodnight by Rennie Harlan. And it's just kind of a mediocre action pick with an interesting premise I've always thought about a hit woman who has amnesia and ends up just living along this normal suburban life, raising a kid and, you know, loving family home, who just suddenly starts realizing that she was something else in her past, something really dark. And I think if you were to make this movie a little darker, a little less kind of cliched, a little less action-y even, you get a more interesting flick. I think it's something more along the lines of Cronenberg's A History of Violence from a couple years ago. Something a little darker, a little more dealing with exactly how this affects her and her family. I mean, History of Violence is practically a remake in a sense that it does seem so similar to Long Kiss Goodnight, but just a cool premise that could have gone to a lot more interesting places than it did.
Yeah, and I like that movie, too, as a guilty pleasure, so I almost put it on that list, and I almost put it on this one, so I guess we finally got it in there. My number four, also an adaptation, I guess it's the only other one on my list, but it's of a comic strip, and it's called Little Abner by Al Capp, is the comic artist who drew that strip. It was a wonderful strip, not so known today, because once strips go away, you don't ever hear about them again, and this is from a couple generations old now, a few. But it was a very long-running strip about a couple of, about a whole family, about a whole town of yokels in the Deep South, and some adventures they went through. And there were a couple movie versions. One was a really super low-budget, absolutely terrible black and white comedy. Another was a musical version that I haven't seen, but I don't really want a musical version of it. Maybe it's okay, but I'd love to see this comic strip brought to life in a modern film. You know, introduce it to audiences that have no idea what they're missing with this great world here and wonderful sense of humor.
Interesting pick, a comic strip adaptation, okay. Well, my number three is my adaptation, and it's not an adaptation of a book, though, it's of a TV show, and that's the film Mission Impossible. We've had three movies in this series so far. I've only liked one of them, but the original film directed by Brian De Palma. I'm not a fan of De Palma, and I didn't like what he did with the film at all, but if you watch the first 15 minutes of that, maybe not quite that far, maybe the first 10 minutes of the original, you see all the potential that a great Mission Impossible film could bring. And it would have to, you know, focus on the things that the television series did. Subterfuge, teamwork. I mean, the Mission Impossible series, kind of repetitive as a long-running TV show, but also, you know, endlessly clever, and it's like every week was a different kind of a heist movie where they weren't really stealing something, though, you know, sometimes they were. Just all these different objectives and all these different people who had their special, specific roles. You know, it's something we've seen over and over, but there's something just, I don't know, there's something special about Mission Impossible and the kind of high intrigue. It's like James Bond if he, you know, had a whole team of guys working with him who each had something special to do and there wasn't nearly as much action. So not really like James Bond at all. Unfortunately, the Mission Impossible series has kind of become a sort of pseudo-James Bond series. I thought Part 3 got away from that a little bit, though. I mean, it's still largely all about Tom Cruise just going out and doing his thing with some other guys kind of in the background. If you made a real team-oriented, subterfuge-oriented movie, I think you'd really have something here.
I think you would, too. I think what makes Mission Impossible special is, if you watch the show, virtually every episode, at the end of the show, the bad guys crush, the good guys win, but he doesn't know what hit him. The bad guys, still, even at the end, after everything has happened and everything's gone down, and he has no idea that he's been conned, and the good guys, the team, they just walk away, and mission accomplished, and no one even knows that they were there. I mean, wow. I don't think anything else really does that, and that's just really neat, and I'd love for the movies to do that, but they seem insistent not to. Well, my number three choice is a movie called Behind Enemy Lines, and it's a movie from earlier this decade starring Owen Wilson, sort of an unlikely action hero, but he does fine. He's trapped behind enemy lines in Bosnia, and Gene Hackman has to go get him out. So that means locating him and maneuvering into a pickup point, and that means Owen Wilson has to get to a pickup point and navigate all kinds of obstacles. It's got all kinds of potential. I mean, the cast is great, and some of the action set pieces are pretty great. The problem is that the movie keeps throwing out the tension with this one really stupid thing after another. It's just weird. It's the kind of movie where you just can't help but ask all these logistical questions about, you know, why does Owen Wilson take off his disguise while he's still out in the open? And why is the street rigged with a bunch of tripwires that apparently all set each other off? And why does Hackman need to triangulate Wilson's position when he knows he's at the agreed-upon rendezvous point? There's, like, things like that, that if you just have one or two in a movie, you can forgive it. But this is just endless. This movie is so stupid, and yet there is, I think, a great action suspense thriller in there somewhere. It just needed to not be dumb.
Yeah, interesting. I could see how that premise could really work, but yeah, nobody likes that movie, I don't think. Did you know there's a sequel, by the way, a direct-to-video sequel?
No.
Yeah.
No, I didn't.
Well, I'm sure you want to go check it out. Maybe I'm sure that it improves. Yeah. Exactly. I saw it in the video store.
That was the remake I'm looking for.
Absolutely.
I'm sure.
I bet that one's really intelligent. Well, my number two pick is a film called The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes from 1970. It was originally directed by Billy Wilder, a director that both Sam and I love, but just the movie doesn't quite ever work. But it has such an interesting idea. You know, I was a Sherlock Holmes fan growing up, and the idea of the film is that it's going to present to us sort of the lost Sherlock Holmes story, stuff that for one reason or another, maybe because didn't work out at the end, or it was a little too salacious for the times. Dr. Watson couldn't publish, so they'd been locked away in a vault for a century or whatever. And there's so many things that you could do with this, and it was kind of an episodic, big-budget film, and it never really kind of comes together. It was big-budget, but it still looks kind of cheesy at some points, and I think if you were to do this again today, sort of a movie that took the Sherlock Holmes spirit, the real spirit of the original stories, and tried to maybe shortly sort of uncensored versions. There's a lot of fun you could have with that, a lot of different ways you could go with it. I could imagine it being dark or being kind of satirical or who knows what you would do with it. There's so many different things, and yet the movie we get is kind of bland and really sadly kind of forgettable. But boy, if someone were to do this again, I think you could come up with a great flick.
Yeah, although I think I'd prefer to just see all the footage Wilder shot. It was dramatically cut down. All right, well, my number two, I only wanted to remake half the movie. And that would be the second half of Snake Eyes. Brian De Palma, speaking of De Palma, movie with Nicolas Cage and Gary Sinise. The opening, I think I mentioned this in our top six openings, just a fantastic opening, this wonderful long shot of Nicolas Cage going about various aspects of his very hectic and frenetic life that are going to come into play later on in the movie. And the second part isn't that bad either. It starts to explore a death that occurs at a boxing match, and we, as Nicolas Cage goes around and questions different people's accounts of the story, then we start to go back and see the same scenes from different angles and get different information each time we go back. That's really neat, too. Starting at the point that we are revealed who the villain is, I think, then suddenly, oh my gosh, it's like you're watching a different movie. It just gets terrible. I mean, it's not interesting. It's not well acted. It's not. It's just. It's one of the worst movies you could imagine. So I would love for these people to go back, take out the second half of the movie or wherever that point is, and redo it. Like rewrite it. Go back to brainstorming the ideas, rewrite the script, reshoot it, and everything, and just give me the second half of that movie that the first half promised.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you. When they reveal the villain way too early, the entire movie, the fun of it is watching Nick Cage trying to figure out what's going on. Once they reveal to the audience before Nick Cage knows what's going on, it's not interesting anymore because you're watching him try to solve a mystery you already know the answer to. It. Just a huge storytelling mistake. I've never understood why that is. And yeah, I do like the whole idea of this murder taking place in a public, super public environment with all these cameras and trying to place together what happened. That's a cool idea that you can do a lot with. And like you say, the movie just drops the ball entirely. It's so strange how bad it gets. And it's for no reason because it does set it up. Well, my number one, let me go ahead and give you the premise and see how quickly you can figure out what movie it is, because probably you'll get it pretty quickly. A couple of really wanted bank robbers abduct a family, and they're going to hold them basically as hostages so that they can get out of the country. They're going to flee down to Mexico. And they say, look, we're not going to kill you guys. We just need you to smuggle us down to the border because, you know, there's too much heat on us, and we'll let you go. So they smuggle them down to this RV, and the bank robbers say, okay, we got to meet our contact down here, and as soon as we've met up with him, you can go. And They go into a nightclub, and all of a sudden it turns out that the nightclub is overrun with vampires. I'm, of course, talking about From Dusk Till Dawn, a movie that has such a great and insane premise that you could have made a really wonderful movie, and considering that, you know, there were actually some good people behind it, Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez collaborated on this film, and it's got a lot of great actors. George Clooney's in it, Harvey Keitel. You could have really done something here, but it gets way too silly and just really stupid and almost kind of slapsticky when there's not just being pointless gore, and it just doesn't really work. I actually think the first half, before the vampires show up, is a pretty decent flick, and then, of course, the vampires should make it much, much better, but they don't, and it just becomes kind of a rote action movie that feels like it was something John Carpenter might have done in the 1980s or something. I don't know what's wrong with this flick, but I think if you make it, and just make it more serious, remove all the slapstick elements, tone it down, and make it a little more kind of a horror psychological flick, you would have a really, really great movie.
Doing a vampire movie has got to be one of the riskiest things ever, because there are a couple good vampire movies, but I think the failure rate is higher than for anything else.
Absolutely.
Anyway, well, my number one, pretty obscure one, it's an adventure film made by Frank Capra in 1931. Now, not only should this be remade, but it seems like it would be an incredibly commercial modern film if it would be remade, so it might be wise to do it just for money reasons. And it's called Dirigible, and it's an adventure movie about an expedition to the South Pole in this airship. And so there's an interesting mix of different types of characters here, some U.S. Navy guys, this French explorer, and so on. It feels very modern in that sense. And the two main characters have this interesting rivalry going on. I mean, they're sort of friends, but various parts of their lives sort of come between them. I mean, they've taken different career paths, made different decisions, and have some history in World War I, and of course, they're in love with the same woman back home. So, you know, one of them has a secret about that, and the other one doesn't. But, you know, they like each other. But it's the really good character stuff here to anchor what is really this interesting action-adventure film. You know, they go to the South Pole, there's a lot of things, there's some disasters that happen there, and some creative things they have to do to survive a bunch of different situations. It does feel like a very modern type of story, but this is 1931. The problem is it was made during that awkward transitionary period from silent films to sound. You know, sound technology was finicky and required this static kind of staging to get right, and this is a story that really demands to be full of movement and action and everything. And the sound quality, you know, wasn't good anyway. Choppy direction and everything. I think a sleeker storytelling style would really bring this story alive and make it this great, exciting adventure movie.
Interesting. I'm not that surprised that you picked an adventure movie for your number one flick, but then again, I picked a vampire bank robber movie for my number one, so what's that say about us? Let's recap. My top six films I'd like to see remade. Number six, the sequel to Men in Black. Number five, the film Face Off, a movie that a lot of people like, and I just can't fathom why. Number four, The Long Kiss Goodnight. Number three, not necessarily a remake of the Mission Impossible films, but a good adaptation of the Mission Impossible TV series. Number two, The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. And number one, The Vampire Bank Robber From Dusk Till Dawn.
And my number six, Multiplicity, the clone comedy with Michael Keaton. Number five, The Lady in the Lake. Number four, a good version of Little Abner by Al Capp. Number three, Behind Enemy Lines from 2001, I want one that's not stupid. Number two, Snake Eyes, just want to remake the last half of it. And number one, Dirigible from 1931 by Frank Capra. I think it would make a good modern adventure movie.
We're going to continue our discussion that we started last week about the Coen brothers in our second part of our director spotlight on Joel and Ethan Coen. We're going to talk about their movies. So let's just jump into it with Blood Simple from 1984. It's kind of a low budget. You know, it's not super low budget, but it is low budget. Crime thriller about murder and blackmail and crazy misunderstandings where you think people are dead, but they're not. And it's a good movie. It's actually really strong, a really good thriller. Both Sam and I really like thrillers, so if you like kind of old-fashioned Hitchcockian-type thrillers, this is there. Not quite Hitchcockian, but not that far off either. At the same time, you know, it's not as good as some of their later films will be, I think, but you can definitely see for a first effort, it's amazingly good.
I would put it in maybe their top 3 or 4.
Really?
Yeah, I really liked. I thought this was pretty strong. There's a, you know, it's, I think this is the thickest with atmosphere. It is, you could just, I mean, a lot of their movies have really great atmosphere in it, but this is so thick. I mean, nothing feels like this. No other movie feels like this. Some feel almost like it, but not as much. And there's all kinds of twists to the story. It's just ridiculous amounts of plot twists and surprises and black humor. Visuals, I love the visuals, especially at the end, you know, the bullet holes through the wall or, you know, things like that are just really memorable. You cannot forget them. There's some interesting situations, actually. With most thrillers, you know, the cardboard cutout type, the characters trust each other far more than the audience does. We're always saying, "Oh, that guy's a bad guy," or "That guy, I don't trust him," you know, something like that. It's, I think with this movie, the reverse was true. The characters don't trust each other, and me as part of the audience is like, "No, he's okay. You can trust him. You know, let's get on with this relationship here." A real weird dynamic, actually.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
You know, it sort of makes it unique.
Yeah, man, now you're convincing me. Maybe this one. I think you're right. I really love it. I really, really love the climax, which is kind of low-key, but completely feels realistic. A lot of thrillers go over the top at the end and lose me.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the ending, the actions that the characters make all seem like things that might actually happen, and I enjoy that. I like that in a thriller.
Yeah.
Well, 1987 is Raising Arizona 3 years later, and a complete departure. I gotta imagine that if you saw Blood Simple in 84 and you loved it, you know, maybe excited if these two filmmakers should do something else, you probably wouldn't have guessed that their next movie was going to be a comedy starring Nick Cage about a couple that kidnaps a baby and gets stalked by the lone biker of the apocalypse. I don't know how to really describe this. Except, you know, there's a scene that features Nick Cage with a pair of pantyhose over his head holding up a convenience store, demanding all the money in the cash register, and also this box of Pampers, diapers. It's surreal, it's strange, it's brilliant. Oh, the voiceover narration alone just totally makes it for me. Nick Cage is wonderful.
I don't know. Maybe it was Utah.
Yeah, it's but it's, I think it's hard to describe what it is that makes it. It's just, it's funny. A lot of people don't really like it, I think. You know, you either like it or you don't, and there's no real bridging that gap. It's a bizarre style of humor, but...
Yeah, you have to be as twisted and warped as the Coen brothers are to appreciate it, but fortunately we are.
Well, they just completely switched gears again in 1990 with Miller's Crossing, which is a pretty straight ahead, and, well, I don't mean straight ahead, it's what you would expect. It's a gangster flick, though it's a really, really dense, I think maybe a little too dense of a plot. It's, like, hard to figure out who's on whose side, but if you don't mind being a little confused, I think it's a pretty effective movie, very evocative, great, great dialogue, like we mentioned last week, really layered and nuanced and just wonderfully written with real music to it. I think you just listen to the dialogue and tune everything else out and enjoy it quite a bit.
Oh, the dialogue's fantastic. Especially, there's a lot of monologues in it. There's these ruthless monologues and these pleading monologues. But, you know, there's a lot of imagery, too. I mean, we talked about the cigar-smoking fat people. There's these long hallways and dripping blood. And it's real in a real eerie sense. Creepy plot twists. And under it all, it sounds pretty gruesome, and it is pretty brutal, but there is this great sense of humor. I think this movie has the funniest machine gun fire of any other movie.
Oh, yeah,
and
absolutely.
And it's just as crazy as that sounds. Just another historical note, kind of. This is one of the first movies where they worked with a lot of the actors that they would continue with, too, I think.
Yeah, I mean, John Polito, John Turturro... yeah, lots of guys show up in this. We're going to show up again and again and again, though. I mean, even in Blood Simple, we have Frances McDormand, who will show up a couple times, and Holly Hunter is in Raising Arizona. But yeah, certainly Miller's Crossing. And definitely by the time we get to Barton Fink, I think, in 1991, the next movie they make, we're going to see the bulk of the Coen sort of regular cast assembled. They keep adding to it, but Barton Fink's got, you know, Goodman and Turturro and Buscemi. Everyone's in it. We've talked about Barton Fink in the past. We did a film spotlight on it previously. Do you have anything to add to it?
I don't think I have anything to add. Just to reiterate in the context of this segment, you know, this is my favorite Coen Brothers film. I love the link with old Hollywood. I love the sense of humor being meshed with that and the idea of needling pretensions of writers who are trying to really accomplish more than they are capable of. Really knocking down pretensions. But it's, it surprises you. It's funny. It's spooky. You never know where this movie's going to take you, and I really appreciated that.
Well, in 1994, they returned to comedy with The Hudsucker Proxy, which is an homage to screwball comedy starring Tim Robbins and Paul Newman. And it's another movie that a lot of people don't like. I don't know. I think their comedic efforts are not quite as universally liked as their more dramatic ones. I love Hudsucker. I think every bit of it, it's completely over the top, and it's kind of silly, and that doesn't bother me at all. I mean, it's such a wonderful film.
Yeah, this is one of my favorites as well. It's probably my favorite of their comic, purely comic works. Part of that, of course, is I love screwball comedy. It's one of my favorite genres from the classic Hollywood period. But yeah, they just play with style in such an interesting way and make good humor out of it. We got Paul Newman as this scheming executive, and
yeah, his name, by the way, is Sidney J. Musburger in the film, and that's,
isn't that wonderful?
Yeah,
that's wonderful. And we got Jennifer Jason Leigh, you know, basically playing Katharine Hepburn, and just wonderful dialogue. And I love the way they play with a lot of the styles of the screwball comedy. There's this one very memorable scene that takes place in a restaurant, a couple characters meeting and having an important moment in their relationship. And any other movie, I don't know, any other filmmaker would not even think of shooting it this way, but they go and shoot it from the perspective of two people, strangers in the restaurant that we never see.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, you know, it's off some table. These two people are having dinner together, I guess, and they're just basically spying on the other couple. They're just watching what happens, and they're narrating it to each other. Oh, now he's doing this. Oh, now she's doing that, and she's saying this. We can't hear what they're saying, but of course, obviously, their observations are spot on, and in context with the rest of the movie, we get the gist of what happened, but it's just in a really funny way, and gosh, what a weird way, too.
Well, the best thing about that, too, is that they're deliberately commenting on the cliches. She's not going to faint, is she? Oh, there she goes. And it's it's a clever way, because they have to have that scene. But that scene, you know, you get the feel that they knew when they were writing it that it was perfunctory. So maybe they added these guys in as a device to make fun of the movie, which is... you know, this is sort of the way that the Coens work, where they're always on a couple of levels. I mean, it's just straight out funny if you don't think about it at all. But if you look at it a little bit, you can think, oh yeah, okay, they are really commenting on what they're doing. It's that clever multi-layered thing that I think... I mean, these are guys who make really critically acclaimed movies that are also popular with general audiences, I think, for that reason.
Yeah, and then one final thing to add, the template of the screwball comedy does not demand it at all. However, there is, I think, one of the best twist endings of all time.
Oh yeah, that's great. You're watching. You think that it can't possibly, how can it end like this? And then, and again, there's another clever thing. If you really think about the ending of that movie, you realize precisely what they're doing. They're being very, very literal. So there you go. Anyway, Fargo in 1996. This is in my opinion, the best of the Coen films. How much is there to say about Fargo? We talk all episode about Fargo if you really wanted to. But a great crime movie.
Yeah.
We've mentioned how wonderful McDormand's performance is, but so is everybody else's, especially William H. Macy, who just gives a wonderful performance as a man who's cornered and just keeps digging himself deeper and deeper and deeper into it. Just a wonderful performance, but everyone gives great ones, and it's such a great-looking movie. I don't think you could make Snow look that interesting as they do. And I'm really just a fan on pretty much every level of this movie, and also of its sense of humor. I mean, a movie this dark should not be as freaking funny as it is, because it's just constantly full of jokes that are often made in inappropriate times. I mean, well, my favorite point is when two of the killers are arguing about what they're going to do. One of them, Steve Buscemi, wants to just go and he wants to go get some beers and pick up some prostitutes. The other one demands that they go to IHOP and get some pancakes. Steve Buscemi's like, well, we just had pancakes this morning. Look, women first, you know, we'll get these women, whatever. And the guy's like, no, pancakes first. It's just a hilarious, weird conversation.
Yeah, there's a strange mix of tones here. And I think that puts a lot of people off. You know, why are you doing that? Why are you going off on this tangent? But it's not really a tangent. It's what the movie is about. It's this amalgamation of a lot of interesting things in their own right, but kind of packed together in a way they wouldn't expect. And yet the film still feels pretty tight and controlled. So
absolutely,
it's kind of an oddball.
Well, again, I mean, it's hard to talk about these dudes because they seem to be intentionally just changing around constantly, because their next movie is a total comedy, The Big Lebowski in 1998, which stars Jeff Bridges as the Dude, a slacker in Los Angeles in the early 1990s who really just wants to bowl and get high and gets somehow drawn into this web of intrigue and kidnapping after two guys mistake him for somebody else and urinate all over his favorite rug, which, dude, that rug really tied that room together, didn't it? I mean, Sam, you don't like this movie, do you?
I'm not a big fan, no. It's a little too weird for me. It just takes it one step further, and it's like, you know, I lost the connection that I had with the characters. No matter how weird Raising Arizona got, I could still identify with Nick Cage and Holly Hunter. And no matter how weird the Hudsucker Proxy got, you know, there's still, I could latch on to what they were doing in terms of that genre. And so I understood the characters because they were playing characters that are obligatory in that genre. And here, I'm not sure what to make of it. I'm not sure that I really, I mean, that's almost the point though, but it just, I don't have anything to get into and like. I suppose it's just a different sense of humor, which is weird because it's not all that different from their previous comedies, but.
Well, I think John Goodman is at his absolute funniest here, at the very least. I mean, him just playing Vietnam veteran Walter Sobchak, who jumps out of a moving car with an AK-47 because he's going to go foil a kidnapping plot. Previous to this, he has thrown his dirty undies out the window in a briefcase, pretending it to be ransom money. And when the dude says, what do you have, a gun? What do you have, this rifle? He's, well, dude, I'm not going to jump out of there naked, am I? And he just starts shouting in this crazy tirade. And the entire way through, John Goodman just pretty much only has two levels in that movie, not speaking or shouting. And I don't know. I think if you lived in Southern California and you knew four or five people who are exactly like the dude, maybe it would work a little bit better for you.
That maybe is the prerequisite, yeah.
Yeah, come out and hang out in L.A.
I do like the idea that he goes by the dude and he wants everybody to call him that. That was funny.
Or maybe El Duderino if you're not in that whole brevity thing.
Yeah.
So, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? 2000, another shift in style. This is, I think, one of the most gorgeous-looking movies, if nothing else. And also the one with, far and away, the best soundtrack. The soundtrack, I think, was more popular than the movie. It was, like, at the top of the albums chart for, like, a year or something straight. It's just ridiculous. And it's not at all the sort of thing that you would expect to be popular, because it's all old-timey, you know, folk and bluegrass kind of music, but just wonderfully well done.
Yeah, I Am a Man of Constant Sorrow is a real bluegrass hit in an age where bluegrass is not exactly popular.
Right, and
I
even,
love the music.
Know, yeah, and the rest of the soundtrack, most of it is just, you know, old-timey songs that, you know, how'd they make You Are My Sunshine popular again? That seems impressive. But there you go. Again, we get the sense it's so evocative of a time in the nation's past that they're so good at. You know, one thing we didn't really mention is that they do intentionally set a lot of movies in the past. Even a movie like The Big Lebowski, which takes place more or less in the present, really took place in the past. It came out in 1998, and I think it was set in 1990 or 1991, or I think 91, and right during the first Gulf War. I mean, just always intentionally recalling things in the past, while Oh Brother intentionally recalls the Great Depression and that era. And I mean, its title is a throwback to a Preston Sturges film called Sullivan's Travels from the 1940s, which is all about a movie producer who wants to make a movie called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou during the Great Depression and decides instead to make a comedy. Well, we have Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, a movie made well after the Depression that's set during the Depression and is a comedy. So, I mean, again, a little bit of Hollywood trivia. Well, The Man Who Wasn't There is another just jump for them in 2001. Here is their most noir film, deliberately structured like a noir. It's set in the very late 40s, and it's shot in black and white. It was actually shot in color, using color film stock, and then digitally altered into black and white, so you get this weird richness that really couldn't have been achieved using just regular black and white film. A pretty clever thing to have done, and it comes out looking really, really nicely. But it's a great, great noir flick, and it's surprising in the way that, for the most part, it plays noir pretty straight. We've talked about neo-noir and how it's tough to make it because they're too self-conscious, but for the most part, I think this comes pretty close. The dialogue is definitely Coen Brothers dialogue, so it seems kind of modern, But I don't know, I think the Coen brothers' dialogue, it's kind of timeless in that it doesn't really reflect modern filmmaking so much as their own style of filmmaking.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
You could kind of see, if they had existed in the past, you could see them using very similar dialogue, you know, in the 40s. Might have gotten out okay. Certainly, I think they would have been okay with the style of acting actors employed back then.
Yeah, I absolutely love The Man Who Wasn't There. I think it's the best of their, you know, in the second half of their career or so for me. But yeah, it looks gorgeous. And I like how it has a real complexity to it. It's not just a straight story. You can watch it as a straight story, but a lot of plot twists, individual plot twists, have these layers of irony, and you can watch the movie on another level as well if you wish. And again, I love how the Coens consistently manage to make these ordinary sorts of things really funny. I mentioned how the Miller's Crossing has the most hilarious machine gun fire in all of movies. I think this movie has the most hilarious car running off the road scene in all of movies. And there's just no way to describe why it's funny unless you see it. And once you see it, you know, think about why it's funny.
Yeah, great movie. Great, really funny. I mean, it's great drama.
And also, I also want to mention Billy Bob Thornton, one of the best metabolically challenged characters in the movies, too.
My favorite thing about that movie is how Billy Bob Thornton is playing a guy who doesn't like to talk, and he's the narrator. I mean, he doesn't have anything to say, except he's constantly talking to us, but not to any of their characters. I mean, it's a lot like, they love that kind of gag. There's that bit in The Big Lebowski where the narrator loses his train of thought, kind of starts rambling, and says, "Oh hell, where was I? Ah, never mind." I mean,
yeah.
And that's actually how The Big Lebowski opens. I mean, I like the Coens. They play around with that stuff a lot. And again, it's that working on multiple levels kind of thing. It's just funny in the moment, but it's also funny if you step back and think, yeah, Billy Bob Thornton, yeah. Narrator, guy who doesn't like to talk a lot.
Right. Oh, and the other performance for that movie that is really great in a different way is Tony Shalhoub.
Oh, who, yeah.
People know from Monk these days. He's on the television show Monk. It's actually a pretty good show. But he plays this, in a review I wrote for it, let me just quote myself just to be a little pretentious here, but Tony Shalhoub, who gets a second chance at delivering a personally prized speech on the meaning of life in a moment of glory. And that pretty much sums up his big scene there, didn't it?
Yeah, oh man, I really love his performance in that. Yeah, you know, we sit here, we're talking about Man Who Wasn't There as though it were a comedy, and yet the movie is a pretty serious drama. I mean, it's a movie about killings and blackmail, and there's all these twists and turns and people on trial, and yet, yeah, all we're talking about is how funny it is. This is why I love the Coen brothers.
Well, that's the Coens.
Well, you want to talk about Intolerable Cruelty?
Yeah, it's a step down for sure. It's, as you mentioned last week, they came on board after the fact, so it's not something they gave birth to themselves, but they came in and kind of mixed it all up, and you sort of get that sense. It plays like a pretty conventional romantic comedy, actually. I mean, there's a divorce action, and the lawyer is representing the husband, but they get involved, and I don't know, it's kind of a pretty typical contrived situation. And then there are these moments that just are out of the blue. They're almost dissynchronous. And these are Coen moments that are just appear in this otherwise conventional story. Kind of weird. I liked it more than I probably should have, though. I actually did find myself getting into it. I think I would recommend it. I did like some of the plot twist stuff toward the end and these madcap chase kind of things that occur and mix-ups and all that business. I thought that basically worked, but it does feel less cohesive than the other Coen brothers movies.
Yeah, disjointed is the word I would use to describe
it.
Yeah,
that's a good word.
It's weird. When it's being a romantic comedy, I think it works okay. And when it's being a weird Coen brothers movie, I think it also works okay. Well, they never quite mesh. It feels like there are just some elements in there that just feel really out of place. But there is at least one scene that's absolutely hilarious in which a man mistakes something else for his asthma inhaler, and it leads to a funny, absolutely hilarious, but really dark consequences. Anyway, when I saw that, yeah. I was laughing so hard that it was worth the price of the movie for me. Well, their most recent movie was The Lady Killers, a remake, which is not a bad movie. I mean, the original is a total classic, but the 2004 Coen remake is good, but not great. And I feel kind of bad, because the last two movies have struck me as being really underwhelming, and both times they weren't working with their own material. I mean, they wrote the script to the new Lady Killers, but it's based off the old one, and in particular, the old one, I mean, the original is such a good, perfect movie, there's no reason to adapt it. A friend of mine, I think, summed it up best by saying that the Coen version of The Lady Killers is good, but completely unnecessary. After you watch it, all you can think is, well, I mean, it's not really the original, so why'd you bother redoing it? But not bad, and Tom Hanks gives just a wonderful performance as a southern heist man who sets up this big robbery, and then they have to kill off this little old lady who knows their secret. But, yeah, I mean, it sounds like great material for the Coens, and I really like them working with Tom Hanks. I hope someday they'll work together again, but just not quite there. Well, their next movie is slated for release later this year. It's called No Country for Old Men. And apparently, I'm not too familiar with it, but apparently it's going to be a crime thriller about money and cocaine being found and complications that come across it. The IMDb's plotline says, okay, this sounds like a great Coen plot. I'm sure it'll be hilarious. Violence and mayhem ensue after a hunter stumbles upon some dead bodies, a stash of heroin, and more than $2 million in cash near the Rio Grande. So, look, that'll be great. I guess it stars Tommy Lee Jones and Woody Harrelson, which, Woody Harrelson? But hey, it's the Coen, so I'm sure it'll at least be worth watching.
It's the end of the show, and it's time to get back to the trivia question that we introduced earlier. What Michael Bay summer action movie is actually a remake of a Mystery Science Theater 3000 movie? What do you think?
Well, I know this. The Island,
yes,
was a remake, kind of parts the Clonus horror. Is it really technically even a remake, though? I didn't think it was.
Well, I don't think it's officially in the sense that they bought the rights to the story, but it, I mean, it's practically identical.
Yeah, I heard there's going to be a lawsuit over it.
Maybe so, but it's practically identical. so I think it's pretty clearly the same idea. The Clonus horror came from 1979, and it was a pretty bad movie, but a really good candidate for a remake, because you don't want to remake the ones that are already good. They're already good. The only way you can go is down. So, and actually, The Island, you know, not a Michael Bay fan at all, but The Island wasn't that bad.
It wasn't that good either.
Well, that's all we have for episode 42. I'm sorry we don't have more, but we will have more next week. In the meantime, check out our website, allmovietalk.com. And read about what we post during the week between times. Also check out rinkworks.com, rankworks.com, a bunch of entertainment stuff there, including things related to movies. What's up for next week, Steven? I hear we have another episode.
We do, episode 43, which, boy, if you're a big fan of the Coen brothers and their wacky humor, you're sure to maybe not care about Terrence Malick, who we'll be doing a director spotlight on, because he's completely different and nothing at all like the Coens. And I mean that quite seriously. Our top six list will also be movies that play around with perspective. So if you're going to compose your list in advance, think about movies that do something weird with perspective, and feel free to be pretty liberal with that, because I think we will be. And, oh boy, I'm so excited. Another good, bad movie. It's a nice change of pace from those constant famous frame segments, but we're talking all about a great movie from a real German auteur. I'll let you find out what movie it is next week.
Cut! Hey, let's try it again with film in the camera this time.